Clip from Chapter 2, The Gift That Keeps On Rebuking. I never decorate my Vancouver apartment in December. Why bother? Christmas doesn't live there. It lives with my parents in the town where I grew up. Brandon is Christmastown. We are fundamentalists. Not Christian fundamentalists, Christmas fundamentalists. On key doctrinal issues, such as who sits where, what snacks will be available, and which 30-year-old cheesy decoration goes on which table, unyielding fanaticism is the rule. The Santa candles were a case in point. Every year, the standard elements are put in place. There is the party mix, Cheerios, Shreddies, pretzels, peanuts, all baked with butter, and Mum's fruit punch. Come the new year, there's always enough leftover punch to fill a bathtub. Once we got older, it became more important as a concept than as an actual beverage. Any proposed changes to the routine must be submitted to a standard arbitration process, beginning with howls of outrage, proceeding through accusations of heresy, complete rejection, and finally an apology for having brought them up. Once, a little electric candelabra got tossed out, but that followed several arcing episodes and, I believe, a call from the fire marshal. But the Santa candles? There was nothing wrong with those. Four little Santas, posing around the letters N-O-E-L. We never lit them, and it's not like wax goes bad. So what would possess anyone to throw them out? What? It was a senseless crime. You hear about such outrages on the news, but you never think one will be committed by your own mother. Apparently, Mum had it in for those poor Santas all along. She must have. One year, they were just gone. Fundamentalist outrage ensued. Unfortunately for Mum, it happened that Lynn had also come home for Christmas that year. Together, we plotted revenge. Fanning out through the Brandon Shoppers Mall, we purchased every Santa candle we could lay hands on. Short, tall, old school, hot pink. Each vengeful clause was wrapped and placed under the tree. Mum was opening them up all night, one after another. "Another Santa candle," she would say brightly, fixing Lynn and me with a rictal grin. They were the gifts that kept on rebuking. She kept them all. Some of the old-fashioned ones are actually rather attractive. In time, they too became part of the fundamentalist tradition. Clip from Chapter 13, Who Killed Grandma? My stint at an Edmonton radio station coincided almost perfectly with the Gretzky era. I was in the stands in 1985 when the Oilers beat Philly for their second cup. I would witness the metastasis of the West Edmonton Mall from a somewhat larger-than-ordinary shopping center into a thing with dolphins and submarines and its own tidal forces. I would be there for the rise and fall of Culture Club, would play the early hits of Madonna, and the hit of A Flock of Seagulls. My shaggy rugged basement suite was on the south side of town in the district of Petrolia, which promised to be charming someday when the runty little trees grew in. Grandma's neighborhood was just about as far across town as it could be. All the same, we were neighbors. Of all Annie Slorence's grandchildren, only I could be reached with a local call. I was literally her closest relative. Karma can be a bitch. One day in sunny Petrolia, I sat at my fold-up kitchen table, chatting on the phone. No sooner had I hung up when the phone rang again. "Hello," said a cheery woman. "Is this Mr. Burgess?" It was. "Oh, I have been trying to get you on the phone forever. I called and called for about half an hour, but the phone was busy." "Talking to a friend," I explained. "That's nice, isn't it?" the cheerful woman said. "Nice to have friends. It's hard to find the time, frankly. Life can get so busy, but it's nice to have friends like that. Young people are so sociable these days, always talking on the phone. I envy you. I really think it's great to have a lot of friends to talk to. Just great. Anyway," she concluded, "your grandmother's dead.